Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects here on radio at firehouse.com. This show is hosted by Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. This podcast is a monthly podcast looking at the entire apparatus industry from the latest news and other concerns regarding the specification and building of fire apparatus. If you have any questions for the Apparatus Architects, please do drop an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Tom. What's going on?
Good morning, Pete. Here's what we have, Pete, for today's show. We're going to talk first about some recent accidents that occurred. Tom's going to go over some recent industry news, and there's been a lot this month, once again, with the downturn in the economy and the price of skyrocketing fuel. We're going to have some discussion topics, what to expect when your committee conducts an in-process and final inspections at the factory, those factory trips. And we just had a question from a fire chief who was trying to get his committee out there to do a final inspection trip and a pre-construction trip, and the town fathers were giving them a hard time about that. So we'll talk all about that. We're going to talk about the upcoming Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. And for all of our listeners that would love to participate, on Saturday, midday at the show at 12 o'clock in room 339, we are going to have an Apparatus Architect podcast live from the show, room 339, 12 o'clock on Saturday, July 26th. We invite all of our listeners that are going to come out to the show to come join us. Bring your questions. We'd love to have a great show out there and interact with all of our listeners. It's going to be a great time. The Firehouse Show is one of the premier shows in the country, and look forward to meeting and seeing everybody there. Just a great venue in and around Baltimore Harbor. So looking forward to that. This month, like in past months, we've had any number of fire truck wrecks and catastrophes and some other things that we want to go over. Just this past weekend in the state of Missouri, a fire truck overturned. What was interesting about this, the occupants of the fire truck were 41-year-old driver, 34, 20, and 18. All the occupants had seatbelts on. They all unbuckled, and they all walked away. In upstate New York, near the city of Utica, in the Tagberg Volunteer Fire Department, a unit skidded and overturned, struck a tree. They went off a soft road shoulder. All seven were treated at the scene for injuries and then were released. They were rounding a curve. It was a 2002 Freightliner fire truck, rescue-type truck, and it overturned, and everybody there walked away. There's no indication that they were wearing seatbelts, but it would seem to me that they would almost have had to been, given the nature of their injuries or lack thereof. In Burlington, Ontario, Canada, they're trying out a new program with a preemption system, the trucks are actually getting there faster by slowing down. And one of the premier names in preemption, Opticon, which was a 3M company but has since been sold and bought out by someone else, has been installed in the city of Burlington, Ontario, Canada, with great initial results for that. In the state of California, as wildfires just continue to ravage, particularly Northern California, I was out there a couple weeks ago, and every night on the news, it just seemed more and more fires. There's a picture on a website of a fire apparatus that had to be abandoned, was burnt, completely up, charred as the winds changed and overtook a crew. They were injured and burned, but not life-threatening. Big to-do about firefighters and storm spotting. There was actually a firefighter killed within the last couple months out on storm watch. There is some pictures that were sent to the magazine, Firehouse Magazine, of a truck that was wrecked while on storm patrol. Looked like a fairly new Chevy brush-type truck. An engine rolls away during maintenance. The mechanics, for whatever reason, didn't shock the truck. It rolled down a hill, went through three cars, and came to rest in front of a building at a very busy intersection. Always shock your tires. In probably the most serious incident this past month, in the state of Delaware, a medic was killed in an ambulance crash, and so was a patient. They allegedly swerved to miss a deer, and they smashed into a tree. And the medic and the patient were both killed. Very tragic. Our prayers go out and thoughts to the family of both the medic and the patient on board the apparatus. There was an aerial failure within the past week at a fire scene. There was a malfunction of the controls on the turntable. The operator had put the ladder in the ladder down function. It did not go back to the neutral position when the controller was let loose, and it continued down and powered right into a private house and bent the ladder in a V. Again, pictures on most of the popular websites of that incident. Also, there was an incident while an engine in Florida was refilling its tank from a hydrant just outside the firehouse. They started to fill it up and noted some water was leaking from the 5-inch outlet. At the conclusion of the tank filling operation, they went to shut the hydrant down. They heard a thud while they were trying to shut it down, and the water began shooting across the street through this 5-inch outlet. Luckily, nobody was hurt as this hydrant malfunctioned and came apart. And then finally, in a sign of the times, a hazmat trailer and truck are to be sold. This was a truck and trailer that was purchased with federal money after 9/11, and there was nobody really to operate it, and so they decided to sell that truck. We'll probably see more of that in the future. And as we wrap up here, a couple of really tragic fires, incidents, that I remember, and Tom as well, for sure, and Pete. 20 years ago, on July 1st, in Hackensack, New Jersey, at Hackensack Ford, five Hackensack, New Jersey firefighters were killed. Three of them were killed in the initial collapse, and what can only be described as heart-wrenching, two other firefighters were trapped inside a parts closet, pleading for their lives when they finally ran out of air, and they also died. Captain Richard L. Williams, Lieutenant Richard Reinhagen, Firefighter William Krasitsky, Leonard Radomski, and Firefighter Stephen Ennis all tragically lost their lives, and our hearts and prayers go out to those firefighters, their families, and to everybody at the HFD. And then in another incident a long time ago in Kingman, Arizona, there was a bevy of a tank car on July 5th, and several firefighters lost their lives there. And again, our hearts and prayers go out to the families and all those involved in that tragic incident out in Kingman, Arizona, when that tank car bevy. Tom, what's going on in the fire industry? A lot happening, huh, brother?
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, after having listened to those, kind of reliving those tragedies, and those were kind of events for those of us that are in the fire service, it's much like when some other tragic events happened that have impacted everybody in the country. You can remember where you were and what you were doing when you first heard those events in Kingman and in Hackensack. And we fast forward up to July 1 of 2008, and we find ourselves that other major vendors that we've used to be dealing with in the fire apparatus industry have once again announced that they're leaving the emergency services market to go concentrate their sales, marketing, manufacturing, and engineering efforts in other areas. We previously talked in earlier podcasts about Detroit Diesel leaving the emergency services, and it's been announced within the last 7 to 10 days that Caterpillar, who is probably most famously known for their bright yellow earth movers and dozers and other major pieces of excavating equipment, and also has been pretty active in the fire apparatus industry for a good number of years, that commencing with the 2010 engines, they are going to be leaving the emergency services market. And there's really two things, Mike, that I see that are driving this. It was interesting when the Detroit Diesel announcement first came out that some of the, as I call them, the sidewalk superintendents were stating, oh, Detroit Diesel's made a big mistake, and they're going to come crawling back to us and admit they made their mistake and make their engines available to us in the fire apparatus industry. Brief conversation I had with a gentleman from Caterpillar at one of the recent trade shows. It's indicated that, you know, we're operating, and people talk about, you know, world-class operations or operating in the world economy. Well, if this doesn't hit home, the world economy is such that the United States is no longer considered one of the premier places to conduct and transact business. Not surprisingly, it's some of what we might refer to as upstart economies, such as China, and other locales out in the Middle East and the Far East, are where the economy is just booming. And where the economy is booming there is also correspondingly much less government regulation. Hence, a company like Caterpillar and or Detroit Diesel, or anybody else for that matter, can go over and sell their products with much less regulation over in those emerging marketplaces and be able to make a good amount of profit as compared to the profit potential that exists by trying to design your diesel engine into one of the 2,000 to 2,500 custom fire truck chassis that may be produced by the 8 to 10 to 11 people who build and design their own fire chassis. We just don't have an attractive marketplace for that North American fire truck. And I know in past when I've been explaining to people who are not affiliated with the fire service and explain to them how unique that North American fire truck is as compared to what fire trucks look like in Europe and in other locales where the fire service is nationalized and there is much less customization. And people are like, wow, I didn't realize that, you know, fire trucks were so custom. Well, that whole concept of what we've built our designs and our companies around may start to be biting us now, because we find that now with two of the three major engine manufacturers making these announcements, it's going to cause us to either look at it our own internal emerging marketplace here in the United States with some engine manufacturer that maybe hasn't been providing their engines to the custom chassis folks and seeing what is available there, or look at, I don't want to start predicting that the era of the custom fire truck chassis is dead or going to be dead, but we can see the impact that our federal government is having in regulation on our industry with respect to the engines, certainly. And we've talked at length about the NFPA, the 1901 standards, and how robust they are in improving firefighter safety with the mandates there. It's just taking the cost of the apparatus and advancing it much more rapidly than the rate of inflation. And not that we're parallel with the rate of, for example, petroleum products or gasoline and diesel products, but it's certainly to the point if your community was put X amount of money away in a sinking fund each year, and even if you had it invested wisely and it was returning 5.5% or 6%, and you figure that this is really making good money for you, I think we're going to be approaching the era here in the next couple of years, Mike, and to our listeners, that the rate of inflation on apparatus is going to outpace the rate of inflation of what we find in other consumer products that we take, and it's going to potentially have a somewhat of a negative impact on our overall industry. You know, it's great that we have these new safety standards that are going to be promulgated that will take impact or take effect on any vehicle with the contract signed after January 1st of 2009. And for the trade shows that Mike and I have attended so far this year and the other ones upcoming, we've mentioned the Firehouse Expo coming up in Baltimore in the third week, that companies like Fire Research and Class One and some of the people who make the bracketry for things, that they'll now be coming out with brackets to retain helmets inside of the cab. All this stuff does present new engineering and marketing opportunities for the companies that do support heavily our fire apparatus industry. But when you have the overall impact of the cost of the apparatus and the fact that, you know, at least on a custom chassis rig, I'm sure numerous manufacturers are already making overtures to other engine folks that maybe in the past haven't necessarily thought about working in the in with the fire apparatus industry or supporting the engineering efforts to go into those designs. But the long and the short of it is the marketplace and the landscape is changing rapidly. So with that being said, there are some things that we're going to talk about here in a little bit further down the road in our podcast today about considerations of what you might want to start doing within your community, that if there is a perceived need for the fire apparatus, some things you can do between now and January 1st of 2010 from a cost avoidance standpoint to help you purchase that apparatus and not kind of have you standing on a sideline watching the parade go by without any hope of participation. So, Mike, again, it seems like every couple of weeks something else is developing that is just a major impact on where we're headed and what we're doing. And, like they say, I think in some sports, you got to keep your head on a swivel here. You can't crawl into a cave, throw a blanket over your head and pretend that none of this stuff is happening, because it's out there and it is. Any comments or perspectives you have there?
Yeah, I was just thinking about it as well. As the price of the apparatus just continues to escalate, I think the industry is going to have to find a way to streamline the process and to take some man hours out of these apparatus. And you know, fire departments are going to just not be able to afford the degree of customization that we have had in the past. And again, not that custom fire truck chassis are going away anytime soon, but all the bells and the whistles and different size compartments, and we got to have it here. All those attitudes, just from a financial perspective, are just going to have to change. And just to break in here, talk about news in real time, I just got an email from Dr. Hanway at NIOSH that we're going to share some good news. Sizing firefighters and fire apparatus. Safe by Design project is expected to be funded for the next 4 years, beginning in fiscal year 2009. The peer review comments regarding our seatbelt project and safe design of apparatus are very positive, and the score of the project is quite impressive. And he goes on to write, I'm thankful for all those, the support of all those that worked on the proposed anthropometric study for automotive fire apparatus design application. Your input and commitment have made the proposal well-received in a very competitive environment. So the upshot there is that for those of us that have been working on the seatbelt and then the sizing issues in fire apparatus, we are going to undertake in the next 4 years a tremendous, probably unparalleled, unprecedented study of firefighters as it relates to what we do, our equipment, our gear, our apparatus, seatbelts, seating, and everything that goes with that. So we'd like to thank everybody at NIOSH for their support on that project. And in the days and weeks ahead on this podcast, we'll have much more information, but just late-breaking news on that front, Tom. Thoughts on that?
That's great, great information, Mike. I know you and folks like Gordon Routley worked very hard to get this thing moving and get it going. And you can just see that in some of the impacts that have already taken place with a combination of the seating folks and SCBA brackets, seat belts and things like that, all those things that in the past we kind of refer to them maybe ostensibly as creature comforts, but they're things that are really important in the overall design of the unit, step heights, handrail position and locations. You know, just think about this. If you sit in a standard U.S.-made car, and it's probably just because Brother Mike and I, we do a lot of traveling, so we find ourselves in a lot of different makes and models of rental vehicles when we're out traveling. And I just get in the habit, you know, you put the key in the ignition, even a slow person like me can figure that out. Next thing is, you know, put my seatbelt on, and then I instinctively go to adjust the mirrors. Well, it's interesting to me is where the mirror controls are on most cars that you would expect it to be on the left-hand side, driver's door up towards front, you know, normally in positioned in front of the where if you have electric windows or seats where those controls are. But then every once in a while you find one and the mirror controls are not where you lay your palm of your hand down on that rest and they're not there and you start kind of go search for this. Well, take that impact into fire apparatus design where every manufacturer's kind of got their own layout and beyond the speedometer and the tachometer and some of the oil pressure gauges and sensors, but all the other different instrumentation we have inside the cockpit, inside the cab. Think of the multitude of different locations where those things are, or even something as simple as where's the master battery switch and the ignition switch? And everybody's fire truck basically is different. Now, that's not the kind of thing, Mike, that I think most fire departments outside of maybe FDNY and Los Angeles City and the larger user fleet departments actually have in their specifications, which do not favor any one manufacturer, that they tell you by make and model what it's supposed to be and where it needs to be located. But beyond that, everybody else, you go to buy a fire truck. I mean, the master battery switch is located wherever the manufacturer wants to put it, or his design allows for you to put it. And everybody's fire truck is different there. Now, that's just one level of quote customization that we're talking about. That if there were some more things that were standard, it might do something to go to your point, Mike, of talking about you know what we can do to mitigate the price a little bit. So maybe you know we'll just switch things up a little bit here, and we'll jump into that. So having said the fact that you know in the past apparatus cost increased somewhere maybe between 3-4% per annum, and now we're seeing just with the impact of inflation, raw material costs, petroleum costs, that the cost of the raw materials and the purchase components that every apparatus builder is facing, the days of being able to hold those, A, annual price increases, or maybe now they're not even annual. They may go up during the course of the year, that we find that those costs are going to be very tough to keep in line. So here's a couple of things quickly that to our listeners can think about to do to try to at least control it or get the cost somewhat on their side. First thing is to look at the amount of time that the bid has to be good for. I know this varies from state to state, and the great empire state of New York, where Mike and I hail from, I think bids legally have to be out for a minimum of 10 days. And then once it's bid, the bid price has to be good for a minimum of 30 days. In other states, it's pretty standard that the bid has to be, once it's tendered and the bids are open, the bid legally, that price has to be valid for a 60-day period. But here's one of the things you can do so at least you don't get jammed up. Before you go establish your bid date, and you, as the purchaser, need to know what your internal process is going to be. Once the day that, you know, if bids are opened at 11 o'clock on July 1st of 2008, what is the shortest period of time that legally you could review the bids, go through the process, go through the different hurdles that you have to go through, either your own fire department administration or your fire department administration in conjunction with your community in your municipality to enter into a contract with that manufacturer via a written contract or a purchase order. You need to know what that time frame is and be in a position to espouse that to the manufacturer's representatives that you're working with. So before you launch the project, you need to have an idea as to what kind of time frame is entailed there, and ask the question and be forward with each of the manufacturers' reps that you're working with as to, you know, to make sure that the bid can be valid for at least that minimum period of time, and they're not going to say, well, you know, my bid can only be good, we're making this up, you know, for 21 days, and I can't make my price good for 30 days or the requisite 60 days. So you don't get burned there, all right? Second thing that you can do is, and this might be difficult for a lot of the consumers on the fire department side to understand, but when your apparatus manufacturer says, well, chief, you know, or deputy chief or Mr. Maintenance Supervisor, what's your budget here? That might sound like a come-on, like, you know, well, if you're going to tell me $425,000, guess what? My price just became $424,989, and I'm going to give you $11 back in change. Many times the folks are asking that to make sure that he's like your first effort as a reality check, to make sure that what you're asking for in your bid specifications by make and model, particularly with respect to horsepower of engines and axle sizes and things like that, for what you want to do, that you've got sufficient funds in your budget to be able to afford what you're telling the person you want. I guess a good parallel would be, to put things in very simplistic terms, if you were feeding a family of four, walked into your local grocery store with $25 in your pocket and filled up your shopping cart with everything that you think you need for the week, chances are $25 won't cover what you're going to throw in the basket. Even if you buy the store-bought, store-brand cornflakes and not the real deal, the Kellogg's cornflakes. Now, on the other hand, if you walk in the door and you got $75 in your pocket, because experience has told you in the past you get out of the door for between $65 to $68, well, now you're good to go. And it's not that the salesperson is trying to prime the pump, so to speak. He's trying to make sure that what you're asking for in terms of all of the different components, for example, somebody says, I got to have calves foam on this, a calf system on this rig. Not a problem, Chief. It can go on. But once you get into the discussion, unless you're expecting the additive cost of that component to be somewhere between $25,000 to $40,000, depending on make, model, and size, you can say calves foam and spend a lot of money in two words and maybe not have the financial resources to back it up. Now, Having said that, the worst thing that can happen after a fire department spends all the time with the apparatus committee in developing their specifications, meeting with prospective vendors, looking at other departments' apparatus, attending some trade shows, is you put the bids out on the street and one of two things happen, neither which is enviable. One is that you find out that no vendor can meet the budget. Everybody can build what you're looking to accomplish, but nobody can meet the budget requirements. Hence, you've either got to go back for more money or now you've got to take your already agreed to, this is the vehicle that we want by design, and now have to pare something out of that to get it down to the budget number. All right, that's one scenario. The second one, which is one that Mike and I see happen an awful lot, is that the more reputable vendors will bid the spec. If, for example, you've asked for the big block 450-horsepower engine, it matches up with an Allison EVS 4000 transmission, somebody says, you know, I can give you something that still begins with the number 4, but it's a 425-horsepower motor or a 400-horsepower motor, and instead of the EVS 4000, we're going to bid the EVS 3000 transmission. Not that that makes those lesser dollar products bad, but that just put that guy at about an $8,000 to $10,000 price advantage. And he does that there, and he does it with the fire pump, and he does it with a few other things. And pretty soon you say, voila, there's somebody that's $22,000 below that's the low bidder. You look at his product and say, well, yeah, you offered a low price, but you also didn't meet the spec for what we were asking for. And now you're put as the fire chief or the committee chairman or whomever. Now you're fighting for the validity of your technical spec because somebody has showed up to be lesser priced, but they've also been much less in the quality and the component level that's in the unit. So you need to be aware of that. So the things to do, if your department's considering now, in the next 2 to 3 years of buying a rig, you want to buy sooner rather than later to avoid cost avoidance due to inflation. Certainly you want to be able to put yourself in a position to buy before the 2010 EPA engines come around from a cost avoidance standpoint once again and from a technology standpoint of what these things are going to do to the overall design of the apparatus. Another thing that you could look at, and this goes to Mike's comment about the level of customization that we are attuned to, is to seriously, if there's a particular manufacturer or two or three manufacturers that you're interested in, rather than to go and design from scratch the fire truck just for your community, look at some of the offerings and the units that they have produced most recently and see if there's any opportunity to tag on to a larger municipal bid or something that's been delivered in your area to not only cut down the cost for some of the engineering time to do a one-off unit for your department, but to gain some of the cost advantage of the fact that the published bid price is already out there and you can leverage your community's purchasing power off that. One example out on the West Coast that I know that manufactured and supplied a number of units to the Los Angeles County Fire Department, KME, has offered tag-on purchases to other jurisdictions, not only just in California, but nationwide, to tag on to that large municipal bid for both pumpers and tractor-drawn ladders.
Tom, what kind of cost savings could we expect by tagging on to apparatus orders such as L.A. County?
But Mike, that's a good question, and it's kind of hard to quantify for a couple of reasons. One is that it's going to vary widely based on the type of apparatus that your community was looking to do. But the positive aspect that I see, it's much like going into a car dealership where when you go look at the car, you can sit in it and you can look at the features, and then you can go right up and say, well, here's all the components it's got on it, and here's the cost. So right away you know whether you are – you know, within your budget or whether you're looking at something. I guess one of the best examples I can think of, a couple of years ago, my youngest son Chris and I go down to New York Car Show, and we're looking at some BMWs. I've just always been enthralled by that particular brand, and it's cool to sit in them, cool to look at them, and then you get around, you look at the sticker price, and you're like laughing. It's like, yeah, that's about three-quarters of the cost of my house. So, you know, I guess, you know, it was a pretty damn comfortable car because, you know, the car was $86,000. with the tag-on orders, you know exactly what the configuration is, and you can intelligently then discuss with the committee. For example, if the tag-on pumper that's got a 1250 pump, a 750 water tank, two cross lays, and is and a deck gun, front suction trash line, high left, low right, and is set up, it's a basic pumper, but it can get set up with seven pre-connected lines, and the thing is $384,000. Well, maybe your department was looking and said, you know, I really wanted that 1,500 GPM pump, and I wanted a third cross lay, but everything else other than maybe the color of the warning lights, which you can change at a pre-construction at an engineering conference, those other things and the fact that they were now going to engineer one meant the price was $410,000. Well, then, for example, right now we're talking about a $24,000 price savings. Is that a lot of money? Yeah, it might be to some people. And if 24 grand, all that bought was another 250 GPM and a pump rating and a third cross light. If, you know, I'm the fire chief, I'm like, okay, well, as long as we're not designing something that's a lot different than everything else I got in my fleet and it's going to do the basic job for 24 grand, you know, tell me why I want to go start and do my own thing. That's just one example. So, you know, the price savings can be maybe as little, Mike, as, you know, 5 or 6%. It could be as much as 10 or 15% because the fact that you're basically eliminating the engineering costs, and that's a cost of doing business. You know, people say, you know, they think fire truck folks are making tons of money. I can tell you being within the industry, that's not the case. And unlike, you know, you and your wife were going to design a house, you have a piece of property somewhere, you're going to build the Wilbur Ranch retirement home somewhere in Oklahoma, you own the property, what's the first thing you do? You hire an architect. That architect's not designing the house for free. He's charging you money for that. In the apparatus industry, the specification process, the design process, the engineering process, that cost is built into the overall cost of the apparatus. So a lot of times committees think, oh, what's the big deal? I just want this EMS cabinet to be 2 inches wider on the inside. Yeah, that's not a big deal, but now that takes an engineer, that 2 inches might mean 8 hours of his time, and now you've got a graduate engineer sitting there redesigning an EMS cabinet for 2 inches. Now, if that's worth that kind of money to you at $75 or $100 an hour times eight, then God bless you. But that's just one small example of where it just takes the cost of fire trucks, and it, frankly, just blows them up, as they might say. So,
That was another good point that you just made, and I think we need to highlight that even more. There are many out there that go to the trade shows that Tom and I go to that believe that fire apparatus manufacturers are just backing armored cars up and just hauling the cash away, in large sums of cash to banks that are making millions. The reality is that many of these mandates, such as the NFPA and the engine emission standards, all those costs associated with that are just really pass-along costs that are passed on to the apparatus purchaser, and not a lot of money, if any, is to be made from any of that. So although the price of the apparatus continue to escalate, the reality is that so is the cost of raw materials and the cost of doing business. And if anything, the bottom line of most apparatus manufacturers have certainly decreased rather than increased. So, you know, I think we really need to make that point that, the apparatus salesman that meets and greets you and comes into your station and all the way up through the process, these guys aren't getting rich over these latest rounds of changes. Much of those are just pass-along costs and part of the cost of doing business.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. Listen, we're going to take a break here, but just like to remind our listeners that Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan will be down at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore during the week of July 21st. There'll be a couple different programs we're putting on, including a live podcast in room 339 from 12 to about 1:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, the 26th of July. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects on Radio at Firehouse.com. If you have any questions for the architects, please do send an email in to podcast@firehouse.com. And also, they will be available at the Firehouse Expo coming up. They'll be in room 339 on Saturday at 12 p.m. So stop by if you have any questions, if your department's considering the purchase of a new apparatus or in the design process, stop by and ask them some questions in here. Be sure to walk away with some great info. Welcome back, Mike. Welcome back, Tom.
Hi. Thanks, Pete. And for those of you who maybe are not familiar with what Mike and Tom look like, you'll be able to pick Mike out down at the expo. He will be walking around with a large red wagon filled with his encyclopedia of fire truck and engine company knowledge. So you'll be able to, he'll be walking around the floor with that. You'll be able to ask him any question, and if he doesn't know it off the top of his head, just whip out one of the different volumes of the encyclopedia and give you the answer right on the spot. Isn't that right, Mike?
Oh, absolutely, Tom, absolutely.
Yeah. So you'll be able to pick him out. He'll be the guy with the four-tired little red wagon running around. So to bring us back here, we're going to little bit talk about what to expect when your committee conducts an in-process inspection or a final inspection at the factory. And a couple of different issues here, some of which we've had some inquiries in the past, but people have said that when their specifications were reviewed by the municipality and they saw the fact that somebody was going on an inspection trip, particularly if it was an inspection trip to one of the builders that are in a favorable climate, that sometimes they were questioned by the municipal officials, the administrator, whatever, saying, so what's the deal with this? This looks like kind of like a junket to me. But these inspections conducted properly are very valuable for the department to gain knowledge on the how the apparatus actually goes together, particularly if you bring someone that's going to be responsible for the maintenance of the apparatus. The in-process inspection in particular becomes pretty important. In the past, historically, that first inspection, after the engineering conference or the pre-construction conference was conducted, was kind of euphemistically referred to as a pre-paint inspection. And that goes back to the days where the bodies were sometimes actually built on the cab and chassis or maybe built on a cart, and the body got assembled and put all together, and the thought was the committee wanted to see the body before any paint was put on there. And that inspection still might be valuable on certain configurations of apparatus, but by and large, that first inspection is now referred to as an in-process inspection, which means we're going to catch the vehicle at some point in the manufacturing process, obviously before it's done completely, and in a lot of cases, it's left to the discretion of you, the fire department, in terms of working with the manufacturer at what stage you'd like to see it. For myself, I think one of the most beneficial in-process inspections is to be able to see the unit when the major assemblies, for example, on a pumper are completed, but before everything gets mounted up on the cab and chassis. So a good in-process inspection might be, obviously, the frame rails and everything is done, the engine and transmission, axles are in, the cab is mounted on the cab and chassis, may not be complete, but is still somewhat functional. And then you could see the pump and the pump module completed but not yet mounted on the cab and chassis. And likewise with the body. The body would be painted. It would have possibly some of the components inside trays and shelves inside the body, but the body would not fit and the water tank would not physically still be mounted up on the chassis. It's a matter there of coordinating that inspection together with your salesperson and the factory for you to say at what point you would like to see the unit and catch it at that midpoint inspection. The final inspection is really a very detailed, typically can take upwards of a couple of days to go through the entire vehicle, go through the entire specification. If it's equipped with a fire pump, you're going to want to be able to pump test it and run the pump through all the discharges, run water through all of the discharges. If it's equipped with a generator, you're going to want to have the generator run. If it was equipped with other lighting or telescopic lighting, you want to have all of those things operating so that you give the unit a good operational test, and it's not just there to look for fit and finish items, which can be important, but the operational items are much more important than worrying about if there's a little run in the paint and, you know, paint that can be taken care of, that can be identified and fixed. So at both the midpoint and the final inspection, you want to consider to bring a limited number of people, not just rely upon one person, but on the other hand, you bring seven people out and go to conduct a final inspection, and you got one guy's, you know, playing with the lights and somebody else is looking at the position and location of the valves and where the linkages are on a pump, or if you're dealing with an aerial while somebody's looking at exterior compartments, some other guy's wanting to, you know, yank the thing outside and run the aerial device. You want to have, again, a good understanding between yourself as the customer and your salesperson and the factory as to what your expectations are and what you want to accomplish during that visit. We mentioned earlier about that some community administrators view these final inspections as junkets, and unfortunately I have heard enough, you know, horror stories to know that some of these are true of people that went to the apparatus manufacturers, you know, they did a quick tour of the plant, they walked around their rig, said, wow, that looks good, and 30 minutes later, they're out on the golf course or they're heading to the beach or do something, and they're going to come back to their community 3 days later and say the fire truck was great. I mean, that's ridiculous, and that's taking the community's money and spending it for these trips under false pretenses. These inspections are designed to be working inspections. The in-process to catch anything or to make any last-minute changes or adjustments that you might be able to make, and the final inspection, given the manufacturing and the building process, if you expect that unit to be done 100%, because with a lot of manufacturers, there are still last-minute things that are going on, particularly if the unit's going to be lettered at the factory where it might be done, but then there was another holdup on something, so your rig may still be getting some of the reflective striping treatments or other things going on. If you are absolutely adamant you want that thing 100%, you need to be able to verbalize that to your local salesperson, to the dealership, and to the factory to say, you know, you might want me out there on a Monday, but if, for example, two of the compartment doors are still going to be missing and you're dropping the water tank in at 3 o'clock in that afternoon and you're thinking things are going to be wrapped up by Tuesday, that's fine. I'm not coming out on Monday. I'll come out on Thursday. I want to see the unit when it's done 100%. It's a matter of getting on record with what your expectation is, and not just the assumption that, oh, well, we thought it was going to look like this. Major cities like New York and L.A. have specific points built into their specifications where they say these are the different stages that we want to look at the rig. If your department is that detailed, you might want to consider those things. But, again, understand that particularly, again, with the cost of travel, and particularly if the travel costs are going to be borne by the dealership or the manufacturer, that additionally is adding cost to the fire truck. We talked about the rate of inflation back several months ago. My wife and I booked airline flight for midsummer vacation. We're going down to North Carolina, and I forget what we paid for that airfare, but I just happened to check. Was just curious, that same airfare has increased 40% since we booked it in February. Obviously, impact of inflation and the cost of petroleum products for jet fuel. So all these things, if you expect that the community is not going to pay, you know, anything for your travel expense, and all of that is going to be borne 100% by the dealership and the manufacturer, you need to make sure that your budget's going to allow for that. Don't build in four trips for five people each and then be surprised when a guy says, well, you know, four people on, four trips, five guys each, and we need to have somebody from our dealership, you know, go out and accompany you on each one of those trips, and I allowed $5,000 a person for the trip, the travel, and the airfare, and the meals, and the car, and all of that stuff, and the hotel cost, and you're saying 6,000 times four trips, you go, wow, I didn't realize we were spending $24,000 just in trips. that's just one small example of what can happen if you can write something in your spec but not understand what you're asking for or what the cost impact is. So a couple of ideas.
I have a quick
things.
Story on a factory trip that we took that really paid off, Tom. We were doing a rescue pumper, and we went out to the factory, and we saw the back end of the truck, and said, well, what's behind there? Well, nothing. Well, can we put a compartment there? Well, yeah. Well, how much is the change order for that? Be about $2,000 to put that compartment back there. And there were two 6-foot pipe poles there. I said, what's behind the rest of that space? Well, nothing. I said, can we add 4 or 6 more pipe poles there? Well, absolutely. We can run them right back. And the truck was designed and built in 1991, and those changes that were made in 91 prior to taking delivery at that midpoint inspection really have helped improve the firefighting capability and the usability of the truck. We had not considered where we were going to keep cribbing. So that rear compartment that we made at that factory trip, based on that factory trip, now carries all of our cribbing for this rescue pumper. And then the idea of having a few more different kinds and sizes of pipe poles or hooks certainly helps on the fire ground as well. And so by paying attention and going out and doing this trip, we were able to make some really substantive changes that have really helped over the lifetime of this rig to make it a better apparatus and a more functional piece.
Very, very good, Mike. I know over the course of the last couple of weeks we've got some questions that have been sent in from some of our readers and listeners. So what have you got for us this week?
First, Mr. Wilbur, my name is Scott, and I'm a volunteer in New York. I'm trying to put together a school for our tower ladder. There is a gray area pertaining to if the chauffeur operator is allowed to leave the pedestal once the ladder is set. Please make this matter black and white instead of gray. In my world, Tom, there is no gray to this at all. In the New York City Fire Department, in my 27-year career, we have had 3 firefighters either seriously hurt or killed because firefighters have left the pedestal for whatever reason to go do whatever they were doing. And although the need at the time that they left for the aerial device wasn't apparent, as fire conditions changed and as things got out of hand, all of a sudden we have our own people 3, 4, 5 stories off the pavement, and nobody now is on the pedestal ready to come get them. As a truck officer, I consider my chauffeur, my operator, he's my safety valve. If we get cut off from the interior stairs, it's my expectation that if I'm going towards the front of the building, where the towards the street side of the building, that my operator is going to be on the pedestal and ready to come retrieve us and save us. So a good rule of thumb is that the operator must stay with the apparatus, very similar to most places with pumpers. And I know that staffing is short and it could become an operational problem, but that's a safety valve for us. And we really need to have somebody at that operator's position until the fire is determined to be under control by the incident commander. And even more importantly, if the apparatus is pre-91 and has been short-jacked, the apparatus operator that short-jacked that aerial device needs to stay with it until the aerial device is actually bedded to make sure that somebody else doesn't come up, get excited, and take the boom or the aerial over the short jack side and dump it onto the street and hurt somebody and wreck the rig. So thank you, Scott, for that question. There is no gray. It's just purely black and white.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And we've got another question from a George down in Ohio that says, I'd like to drop you folks a question about forward-facing versus rear-facing seats in the apparatus, and was looking for our opinion about that. Well, with the configuration of apparatus, thanks to some of the work that Mike had mentioned earlier with respect to the anthropometric studies of firefighters, we're probably going to be looking at in the future the days of that proverbial 10-person cab with four forward-facing or rear-facing seats are going to be gone, because while you can physically put the seats in there, you're going to find yourself that you can't find four Smurfs that are small enough that are not going to be knocking somebody else's teeth out when they go to mask up, or just even something as simple as to, buckle up their coats, finish getting their gear on, and to engage their seatbelt. It probably comes as no surprise that at least from the majority of firefighters that I've spoken to across the country, given the choice of riding rearward or riding forward, most folks would tend to vote that they like to ride facing forward, to be in the same position as the driver and the officer. They can see the roadway. It does give you a little bit of advantage as you, in a major urban area, and Mike can maybe speak to this, as you're coming into the block, you can, take a look out the window or look through the window and kind of see what side of the street the fire's on, if there's any personnel showing, if you got fire showing, and give you a quick little visual size up as you're entering into the block. With the advent of people wanting to carry more stuff, and I'll put quotes around stuff and capitalize it, inside the cab, it starts out with simple, EMS gear. Other folks have determined that they want to be able to carry tools inside the cab, which is fine, but it needs to be in a certified 9G bracket and not in a Tula clip. Back a couple of weeks ago, Mike, I saw on one of the different fire service websites some young enterprising firefighter was doing a photographic tour around his new rescue pumper that he was rightfully proud of. And when he was taking some pictures of the inside of the cab, I thought for a moment that maybe the Snap-on tool guy was using that as a display area, the amount of hand tools that were mounted inside the cab, some of which were mounted properly in a certified bracket, and other ones that were mounted in Tula clips. I thought to myself, they must have had seating for 37, because if they had the six people out the back, each take four tools each, there still would have been about 25 tools left inside the cab. And that then again borders on the ridiculous. There's a lot of space inside the cab, but we need to think about that from a creature comfort standpoint. And if you're going to come in and out of the cab carrying, whether it's an AED or an O2 bag or your jump bag or a set of irons, you got to be able to keep 3 points of contact getting in and out of the cab. And it's one thing to say, I mounted this in the cab. Then the other thing is, how safe is it to get it in and out? And that has much more to do with where the seats are located. So there is no regulation that says it's got to be front or got to be rear. You need to look at that entire environment, to me, kind of the way you would maybe looking at a modest size bedroom. If you're going through a model home and here's a bedroom, you say, I wonder how my furniture could arrange in there. Well, I could put the chair here and the bed here, or I could reverse it, or maybe I could just flip-flop it and go 270 degrees and put them on opposite, in opposite caddy corner one another. We need to spend some more time organizationally to be able to have this environment to be safe, to think about, no matter what we push, pull, or shove into that little cube, what's it going to look like if it's landing, if the rig is laying on its side, or worse yet, land on its roof, or if it does a 360. There's a lot of stuff that the apparatus industry can put inside the cab. Some of it, I think, Mike, is much more that, we threw every option that we've ever done in there, and we put it in the cab, kind of like in the overall design of the vehicle. And then you come back and you touch the people's pulse later on and say, so how'd that rear-facing seat work out with that center forward EMS cab? Then they'll be like, well, that's great, but the guys much prefer to ride facing forward, so they're riding in that little flip-down seat next to the cabinet, and I'm constantly getting complaints that there's no elbow room. Well, not a surprise to me there's no elbow room, because the guy's sitting up, alongside a, 48-inch-high aluminum cabinet, and he's got no place to put his elbow, and the only thing we've accomplished is, getting him to ride forward. So I think all those kind of things kind of fall into play when you're going to design the interior of your cab. I know you, having spent most of your environment working in the Bronx, those guys riding in the forward-facing seats tend to be able to look out the window and catch to see what's going on as they're entering a block, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Guys riding forward really like that, obviously, from that perspective. But a funny story with that. We had a guy who just, the minute he saw a lick of smoke or a lick of flame, he just got unbelievably excited. So his position on the truck always was to ride facing backwards so that he couldn't see anything. And everybody on board, the apparatus riding forward and looking out, would keep quiet until we got to the scene, and then we'd jump out, and then the guy would finally go nuts. So it prevented him from going nuts inside the cab and screaming and yelling as we went to that scene. But it's a good point that it really does help in size up that you're able to see out facing forward. And like you said, with the anthropometric study ongoing, the days of the four seats either across facing forward or rearward are going to be gone forever. The math just doesn't support that. It just plain doesn't work, and it's not safe. It's just not safe. So that's going to go away sooner rather than later. The other thing to mention is that many times the forward-facing seats are part of a commercial cab and chassis setups where all the seats will be facing forward. And of course, we've voiced our concerns about that equipment as well. I have another question for you to tackle, Tom, though, because I know that this is right up your alley. What do you guys think about LED lights on fire trucks? This particular person writes, I think that LEDs are good in a clear night but bad in the daytime and on a foggy night. Your thoughts?
Well, that's a real good question. If you look at the warning light technology has probably advanced more rapidly than just about any other component that we put on fire trucks. We even roll back 10 to 12 years ago, we were coming up with, had all different versions of halogen light bars and a build-your-own light bar that, you know, you could put up to, like, you know, 27 rotating lamps and one 88-inch wide light bar. The problem was that from an electrical standpoint, that thing was drawing about 85 amps, you know, to run the thing. Enter the technology with strobe lights, and now you look at LEDs, particularly, not that I look forward to seeing these people in my rearview mirror, but I don't think there's too many police departments anymore that you see running, you know, halogen or strobe lights on their cars. Everything is pretty much, maybe if it is, it's strobed down low, and the, all the other lighting is LED technology because of the requisite very, very low amp draw. I think a lot of it depends as where you are geographically. You know, if you live up here in the Northeast where we get all different kinds of climatic conditions, we do get bright sunny days, cloudy days, as compared to if you're in the desert Southwest or in Southern California, the times that Michael and I have been out there, you've noticed it. It's very common. They run much more amber and blue lighting because that lighting is the most brightest, even during the bright daylight conditions. And even there are times that the LED lights may get washed out if you are in very, very bright sun. The issue is if you're in an area where you get fog conditions, or worse yet, you get heavy snow conditions, any type of light that would work to your advantage during the daytime where it would be extremely bright, a clear light, an amber light, or a blue light, an LED or strobe, could get to be somewhat distracting to, if it's in a forward-facing position, to the driver as he's going down the road, and could also be potentially more dangerous if it was in a rear-facing position with having oncoming traffic coming into the back of the vehicle trying to identify where you are. So you'll see a number of departments will go with a combination of LED lights and some strategically located strobe lights, generally in complementing colors to be able to have two different styles of lighting on the vehicle. Again, there's no right or wrong answer with this. Most people have, the lighting folks have done a phenomenal job in coming forth with new technology and improving the product, and particularly with LED lighting technology, with the exception of the clear lights, which tend to be very expensive, dramatically lowering the cost of that product to make it affordable to a lot of folks. So good stuff happening there, and I'm sure as each succeeding year goes by and each season, you will find that a number of other folks will come up with improved lighting capabilities. And this, again, is where you can kind of leverage off some of the larger departments to see what they're using and what works for them. And rather than, once again, trying to reinvent the wheel and find out that you've made a major error and now it's too late to punt. I mean, once you've got the light bar purchased and the holes are punched on a roof, it's a little too late to change it. You want to make sure that you get that nailed down, and that's one item that once you get to the engineering conference, all of those issues can get resolved and make sure that you're doing the right thing. So, Mike, you got time for one more question? What else we got out there this week?
Okay, Mr. Shan and Mr. Wilbur, my department is looking to purchase a new heavy-duty rescue truck, and it will be our first such unit. We're replacing an older ambulance-type rescue truck, and one of our issues is lighting and generators. I have been to Firehouse Baltimore, and we were told of a PTO generator to help expedite the available lighting power on the unit. Can you please explain this and help us determine if it is for us? We're a small department protecting 7,000 people and about 5 miles around. We have two pumpers, a quint, and a rescue. We have a major highway and respond to 24 pins in a year. We also have a small body of water along the highway and average 10 cars in the water. With this type of response, I want to be able to turn on the scene lights as we arrive to help complete the initial size up. Is a PTO what we need? Thank you for your radio podcast and your articles in Firehouse. I have been big readers of your stories and helped guide us through the purchase of our last pumper. Best regards, Dave. So how can we help Dave, Tom?
Well, it's interesting. It sounds like he's got a multitude of different lighting considerations, not the least of which are the 10 folks who in the car who land in the water each year. So a couple of things. A PTO generator is the most cost-effective generator in that you can get these generators up to common sizes, up to like 35 kW, and be relatively inexpensive as compared to their larger, more expensive brethren in the hydraulic generator. The PTO generator is, as its name implies, power takeoff driven off the 10-volt opening on the transmission, goes up underneath the frame rails, doesn't take any compartment space, and again, the scheme of things, relatively inexpensive. The downside to that generator is the vehicle needs to be stopped and stationary before you can generate power, because that generator requires a constant engine RPM to be able to generate 60 cycles. The hydraulic generator, while it is more expensive, gives you the ability, you can take that generator and mount it in a whole bunch of different locations. Generally, you do not mount it up underneath the frame, so it is going to take up some space within the body or in top of an exterior bin compartment on a non-walk-in rescue, but it does provide the opportunity you can generate power as you're going down the road. Now, if you want to combine the best of both worlds and keep the cost down but still be able to have some exterior lighting as the unit is mobile while you're operating, you can do that with the combination of some exterior 12-volt lighting, brow lights or scene lights that are available from a couple of different companies like, you know, Quick Rays and Fire Research to name a couple, and Akron Brass has some lighting of that is 12-volt operated, powered by the chassis electrical system, so it would enable you to still keep a high kW output PTO generator that once the vehicle stopped and stationary, you could imagine if from this description, this gentleman where, you know, they're riding down a road and they see maybe a fence, breaking the fence, and now they're looking in the water and trying to pick up some tire tracks or something where the car or the vehicle may have gone into the water, that the vehicle still, our apparatus still needs to be mobile because we don't really want to position it yet. You certainly don't want to stop it, you know, set the parking brake, you know, engage a PTO, run the generator for a couple seconds, say, oh, looks like it's down the road, you know, another 300 feet, and then disengage the generator and start all over again. So there, the combination of the PTO generator together with some of the exterior 12-volt scene lighting supplemented then by generator power at 120 volt lighting once you get rolling there, that might be the most cost effective way to go. Hydraulic generators are very good and very efficient, but they are at the high end of the scale in terms of cost. So that's the kind of thing, as you're meeting with your apparatus representative, you say, hey, I'm looking for something, for example, in the 25 to 30 kW range. What's your company's price difference between the two? And, make sure that you do the right thing. Again, it's, hydraulic generators are great, and a lot of people are using them, but if you don't have the bucks to be able to afford that, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to downsize the physical output of the generator. You just spec something that's going to do the job for you and do it. So there we've had an opportunity to respond back to several questions that have been sent in by our listeners. And, again, we encourage folks, if you're going to be traveling down to Baltimore for the Firehouse Expo, Michael and I will be putting on a couple of programs on rescue truck design and first due engine and truck operations. We're going to be doing that live podcast in room 339 on that Saturday, and we'll look forward to meeting folks and helping you out with whatever issues or questions you have. So wrapping up from Tom, like everybody to have a very safe summer. And, again, anything that Michael and I can do, please send in your questions to podcast@firehouse.com. And we'll be happy to respond to them on the air or answer them in one of our upcoming live podcasts. Mike, any parting thoughts?
Yeah, just like to thank everybody for tuning in and also thank our sponsors, Task Force Tips, for continuing to sponsor our show. And we look forward to seeing everybody at the end of the month in Baltimore at the great Firehouse Expo, our 25th anniversary, going to be the biggest and best show ever. Hope that many of you can come down and be with us and attend. For now, this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. Have a great day.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.